I'm about to change your life, or at least your mornings. Perhaps it's fate that you turned into our podcast where we will be fighting for your freedom. Not freedom from tyranny, oppression, or persecution, but from mediocrity. We are fighting for our right to drink premium coffee that is fresh, never stale, and ethically sourced. Today, we celebrate our Spark Plug Coffee Day!
Now I'm going to salute. That over-exaggerated salute. One of my favorite moments in this whole movie.
That's right. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always fair trade and directly sourced. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this outstanding coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug a la carte or join the Autopilot Coffee Club and have your order arrive at your door just when you need it. It's flexible and customizable, all the convenience with none of the commitment. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 20% off your next coffee order. So what are you waiting for? It's time to take the nuclear option to your stale old coffee routine. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Sparkplug Coffee has left the building.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy end of June and happy end of sci-fi month, movie people. And thank you so much for lighting up the 398th Ellis's Analysis on the Top 100 Project, the never-ending Monday morning lip-wag about classic films. Scroll back in our channel to find talks about Raging Bull, The Seven Samurai, When Harry Met Sally, Malcolm X, and so many more. Those were spoiled from their nose to their toes, and today's movie will be too. I'm the cocky NASA enthusiast who buys extremely tacky engagement rings for their beautiful stripper girlfriend, Ryan Ellis, and here's the classy lady who suffers serious internal injuries, but doesn't look so much near death as she looks like she's just really tired. My wife, First Lady Bev.
That's me.
I love Mary McDonnell, very good actress. Doesn't really sell it very well that she's dying when Jasmine finds her.
Yeah, considering she was injured in an explosion, she has some pretty first-class hair and makeup going on there.
A little smudge, a little blood in her face. And
she didn't die, Ryan.
That's about it.
She just went to sleep. Right, Daddy? Did Mommy go to sleep?
I had a lot of nutshell ideas for this, and one of them was a mourning widower wants revenge on those who killed his wife. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture. Timely one, Independence Day, because we're, about a week or so away from the American Independence Day. 3 years ago, Esquire put together a list of the greatest movie presidents. Who was number one? Was it Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln, Morgan Freeman in Deep Impact, Harrison Ford in Air Force One, or Bill Pullman in Independence Day, also known as ID4? If you look this up, you know the answer right away.
Well, I kind of knew the answer anyway, because I feel like this is an easy one, that it's Harrison Ford in Air Force One. I've never seen it.
Still love that movie. Always did. When I rented it on tape, one of the few I watched more than once before I took it back. Men in Black was another one, same year, 1997. Yeah, Harry Ford's number one. Bill Pullman was second on their poll. Freeman was fifth, and DDL didn't rank at all. And the poll was, well, I said 3 years ago, so maybe 4 years ago, actually. Anyway, I'm a little bit surprised they didn't put Daniel Day-Lewis on there at all, but they had people like Jack Nicholson from Mars Attacks on there, so obviously a bit of a gag. So I was hoping Pullman was number one, but then again, this was a trivia question for us in our bi-weekly trivia game, so I knew he wasn't. But he was a pretty good president, even if in our third movie we've done with him, I do wonder about his acting ability. We'll get to that soon. Okay, Aliens Attack was released by 20th Century Fox 25 years ago on July 3rd, 1996. It was, of course, a gigantic hit, the number one movie of that year. I don't think people really need to be reminded what this movie's about, Bev, but please tell us anyway. Give us a skinny on Independence Day.
It's almost Independence Day, and a massive fleet of alien ships have just descended upon all of Earth's major cities, and they are not here to make nice. An ensemble of Americans, including scientists, leaders, fighter pilots, exotic dancers, and Randy Quaids, each do their part to survive and conquer the alien invasion with moxie, nuclear weapons, 6 white stripes, 7 red stripes, and a hell of a lot of stars!
Yeah, damn right! Or, in a nutshell, The President of the United States helps alcoholic pilot commit suicide. Good luck, buddy. Go die and save the rest of us. We know how to bring him down now. Pass the word. Well, the Americans are going to counterattack. Oh, it's about bloody time.
Best scene in the movie. Everyone in England is just shrugging their shoulders, walking around in circles. Like, what are the Americans going to tell us what to do?
They're not England. They're in Iraq.
Yeah,
that's an English officer. That's true. That's Jim Piddick from Best in Show, the play-by-play guy for the dog show.
About bloody time.
We have no thoughts whatsoever.
They're peevish about the fact that America hasn't solved their problems yet.
In a day.
Yeah.
And only the cable repairman can solve all these problems, the brilliant hacker David. And our second Jeff Goldblum movie this month, and our third this year, because, of course, Grand Budapest Hotel was a few months ago, and The Fly was a few weeks ago. Jurassic Park back in 2018 we did. Of course, Nashville and Annie Hall on the AFI's Top 100 list. A lot of Goldblum over the years on this channel, and he is a fun actor. Okay, there's plenty of numbers for Independence Day. Let's burn through those. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, give it a fresh tomato. 67% of them said yes. For an average of 6.5 out of 10, 75 reviews is the sample, and 75% of audiences. I'm a little bit surprised that's not more like 85 or even 95% of audiences, because this is clearly a crowd-pleasing audience hit, as it was then, and probably still is now. The sequel, Independence Day Resurgence, which was, I don't know, something like 5 years ago. Will Smith isn't in that, but most of this cast, certainly the major players are, the ones who survived, of course. That got 30% and 30% from the critics and audiences on Rotten Tomatoes. Just torched. This was number one at the 1996 U.S. box office. Jerry Maguire was fourth. Chris and I covered that for Scoring at the Movies a couple years ago. Fargo, which you and I covered for the Top 100 Project, was 67th. And Trainspotting, which we covered quite a few years ago, was 97th. The movie is 42nd on Box Office Mojo's top 200 adjusted for inflation all time, with $633 million adjusted. It won an Oscar for the visual effects, pretty appropriate. And a lot of the effects, a surprising amount of the effects, are models and practical. They used digital, but they didn't rely on it the way that so many movies by that point were.
They've doubled the record of models built for a single film.
With the planes and sometimes the aliens and
the White
ships, the White House itself,
yeah. Cities that blew up.
That famous shot of the White House exploding was in a Super Bowl commercial. And one of the most famous Super Bowl commercials at that time, maybe ever. People thought, I gotta see this movie. And of course, it was, what, almost 6 months away.
I mean, among all the influences this film had, its marketing campaign was a really huge one.
That's true.
Ironically, the shot that was in that famous Super Bowl ad is not in the film because censors were squeamish about straight up showing the White House exploding. So that's why they added the helicopter to explode in front of it to just mitigate this image.
But that's better. Now we know for sure people died.
We know the White House is exploding. I'm not sure how that fixes things, but just this head-on shot of the White House exploding, I guess, ruffled some feathers, and they got in trouble and had to water it down just a little bit.
It is a movie, people.
Yeah, it's a movie, people, exactly.
Plus, they won, because USA, USA, David and Steven, and Russell, too.
It's amazing to think that the time this movie came out, it was brand new to see all these symbolic structures get blown up, but speaking of influence, Independence Day was the first movie to blow up things like the White House or is it Empire State Building?
Yeah.
And create this gigantic appetite for watching massive famous buildings get blown up.
We see other big landmarks affected as well, whether it be the alien ship had crashed because they had done what Russell did, which is get inside. We'll get to that in a few minutes as well. The other Oscar nomination, by the way, didn't win this, was for the sound. Didn't get nominated for sound effects, though, which surprised me a little bit. That was won by Ghost in the Darkness. The English Patient won the sound Oscar that this did get nominated for. It was also nominated for a Razzie. Worst written film grossing over $100 million. Twister won that. I don't love Twister, but I don't think either of those should have been in that camp. But there weren't that many movies that cost $100 million back then. And Independence Day was nominated for two AFI lists, the Top 100 Thrills and the Top 100 Genres in the sci-fi category. So what's that? Three, I think, of the movies we covered this month, four sci-fi month, fit that bill. Not Donnie Darko, but I believe AI was in there, and so was The Fly. None of them made the list, but they were nominated for it. And as I've said before, that is probably my favorite of those 10 genres, because they picked 10 excellent ones, but they could have picked 10 other entirely different ones, and they would have been worthy, too. Maybe even 20 other ones would have been worthy. Okay, we had to watch this movie in mid-June, which is a little bit weird for Independence Day, but we got to get the podcast out in time for the actual Independence Day. You've seen it many times. You loved it as a kid. I remember liking it then. It's one of those roller coaster rides. I think I loved it at the time, liked it less as the years went on because I felt, well, I'm grown up. I can't like a movie like this. But we can always have fun. There's nothing wrong with enjoying a relatively dumb movie. with a lot of big stars, some who weren't stars yet. What did you think of it this time?
Well, you're kind of stealing my take, because I too have come very full circle with this movie. I saw it in theaters when it came out in 1996. I was a teenager. I was crazy about it. I thought it was so freaking cool that I revisited it in my 20s, realized that it was actually terrible. The script is insultingly dumb. The film has little to offer beyond the big ticket destruction that you can see in trailers anyway. And now, in my 40s, I love it again. I don't disagree with either of my previous interpretations. I think it is both absolutely terrible and a masterpiece at the same time.
So another 10 years, you're going to hate it again.
It is this enigma, because it is as bad as it is great.
So we start off with the shot of the alien ship coming towards the moon. And they say later on it's a quarter the size of the moon. Anything that big would affect the tides. And probably drastically affect the tides, because the reason we even have tides is the gravitational effect of the moon. And this thing is that big compared to our moon, but it has no effect whatsoever. Never mind the other ships. They're 15 miles wide, apparently. That's a great image, of course, hanging over New York and LA. And we do see other cities in the world, but this is basically an American movie with just some shots of around the world. They did actually shoot in Egypt, Iceland, Australia, and Tanzania, at least briefly, to establish the pyramids and, what do you call that thing in Australia? The opera house?
Yeah, the opera house.
So it wasn't entirely America, just mostly America. But it's interesting, we see the ship first, which is a great way to open the film. Then we see the SETI office, where they hear this incredible sound, which they know has got to be some kind of alien life. But we already know what it is. And it might have been a little bit more low-key to have it be that we start with the dude who's golfing, and he wakes up his boss. Well, I can't make that sound, but what is that? And of course, you know what it is anyway, because you're going to the movie to watch an aliens attack movie. But I do quibble with that a little bit. You already established it. We saw it, and now they catch up to us. But the movie's also 2.5 hours long.
Yeah, 2.5 hours. The first half hour is introducing this massive cast of characters. It's over 20 characters, and each of them independently learning that aliens have invaded Earth. You could start it at SETI, like you suggested. I think you could also start it at Will Smith's house, where he thinks it's an earthquake, and he sees his neighbors are running, and you see his reaction to the ships before you even see the ships. Actually, that's a pretty cool thing, too, this very long introduction in the film. It's actually really drawn out. It never feels boring, but they really spend a lot of time introducing the situation and the characters without really showing you the ships and the aliens. You see parts of the ships. You see the scale of this massive, hard-to-make-out object that dwarfs a satellite that crashes into it.
I love that shot.
It's really
well done. I've seen this movie lots of times, and every time I'm watching it, I'm thinking, okay, it hits it now. It hits it now. Then it hits it.
It's like when you drop something off a cliff and you're like, oh, it's got to be at the ground. It's got to be at the ground. And you only get the true perspective of how deep the cliff is when you see how long it takes for an object to hit the ground. It's like that with the satellite, and it's really effective. And that shadow being cast over the cities, over the Washington Monument, it's incredibly effective. It's really ominous and cool. And it builds up this tension, and it creates this villain who is impossibly imposing. I struggle to think of another movie that has such a massive villain like this.
We don't even meet those villains until about the halfway mark, and we don't meet Will Smith until about the 21-minute mark. So he is effectively the main character in this film. Maybe it's Goldblum, but Will Smith is thought of as the hero.
It's like him, Goldblum, and Pullman.
But Will Smith, it's a star-making performance. He is top billed. He's the man of action. So I think the movie is thinking of him as the star. And certainly watching it now and knowing Will Smith's career, he is the main player. But it's funny to think he doesn't come in until that point. And then the main rivals, and he's the first one to actually meet them face-to-face, punching it out. Welcome to Earth.
So stupid.
That thing is knocked out for a long time, too, from one punch. And it's wearing a biomechanical suit.
He punched him essentially in the helmet.
He does kick it a few times, too. And what the hell is that smell? Which I was reading is a real smell in the Salt Lake Flats. What do you call that? The Bonneville Flats, I guess, in Salt Lake City. We know that they all end up at Area 51. And they make that relatively believable that they do. I don't think all the campers are headed that way. And they aren't, because Russell's the one who talks to Steven. And he says, there's nothing on the map about some base. Trust me, it's there. We know Air Force One goes to the base specifically because the Secretary of Defense knows that it's there. So all that makes sense, basically. But that's where the last shot is, where Will Smith and Goldblum are walking along after they've come back as heroes smoking cigars. So they're back in what looks to be Utah again. But Area 51 is in Nevada.
If we want a Neil deGrasse Tyson this movie,
we will.
We will be here all day and night.
It's fun to do that.
It deserves it. Trust me. There are so many logical fallacies.
One of my favorite line reads of all time, though, is in this movie, and I just mentioned the Secretary of Defense, Lipnicki, what's his name, the James Redhorn character. He's been in a lot of movies in his career. I think he's actually died, maybe quite a few years ago, did die. The character I always remember the best that he played was the jerk principal in Scent of a Woman, where he's accusing, Charlie, you gotta tell me the truth, Charlie. And then Al Pacino comes in and saves the day. But anyway, when they get to Area 51, General Gray, Robert Loggia, who does a good job of this movie, but it's not his fault. It's the way it's written by the director, Roland Emmerich, we didn't say his name, and Dean Devlin, the producer. So they both wrote it. Emmerich directed, Devlin produced. As a Secretary of Defense, you should have told us about this. It's not as bad, because people do sometimes remind each other, look at Mr. President. You gotta call the guy Mr. President all the time. One of the nice touches, actually, is Loggia again at the end, when they've won, and they salute each other, whatever it is, they shake hands. They're going down over the world, Tom, is what Loggia says to Pullman. So finally, he doesn't say Mr. President. It's a human moment. I like that an awful lot. Just like when Pullman says to Gray, he calls him by his first name. I forget what it is right now. William, maybe? So Loggia has a good line at the end, but he has that bad line of, as a Secretary of Defense.
We always use that line as our shorthand for clumsy exposition, where the screenwriter just got lazy and inserted a line that nobody in human speech would ever say. It would be like if I was talking to you and I said, as my husband, we don't need to remind each other about these details of our relationship, but they need to, of course, remind the audience. So that's like our shorthand for this cheap shortcut that screenplays use all the time.
But it made me laugh hearing it this time fresh, because I haven't watched this movie in a few years. The other main character in the film, of course, well, there's a lot of them, but the other main male character in this film is Randy Quaid as Russell, who's pretty fun. This was a big year for him because he was in, I think, four movies in 1996. Chris and I covered Kingpin a couple years ago, where he's funny in that bowling film. And I just saw for the first time Last Dance, the Sharon Stone on Death Row movie. He's got a relatively small role in that. He's very normal on that. Of course, he's in the Vacation films. We covered Christmas Vacation a couple years ago. And when you look at the three main heroes, I guess four main heroes, Will Smith, Jeff Goldblum, Bill Pullman, and we got to include Randy Quaid in this.
Yeah, that's right.
It may be three white guys with a black guy as well, but it's relatively diverse. Because you've got a black guy, you've got a Jewish guy in Goldblum, you've got a very bland white dude as the president, and you've got a maniac in Randy Quaid. He's playing a maniac, and as we know, since he became a maniac.
I know, poor Randy Quaid.
But he was a fun actor, and he was in so many fun roles. And that moment, it didn't happen to me this time, but when he says, tell my children I love them very much, and then he sacrifices himself because what has he got left? And you got to think about this, too. He wants to save his kids and save everybody. The missile malfunctions, he's got no other choice but to, well, thinks quickly, actually, pretty impressively. If you think about it, the speed he's probably going, he wouldn't even have even 2 seconds probably to not have the missile go off and then make this decision. But okay, fine. But it's also very touching that he mentions the children. James Duvall, who's in Donnie Darko last week, is his oldest son. You should be very proud of your father. I am. That's a very touching bit of acting. This is not a movie that's very emotional, but I always like that. Probably better than the First Lady dying.
Well, sure, it's also the big climax of the film. And I would say that even if you're a person that has everything to lose, but you could sacrifice yourself and literally save humanity, you'd be a monster not to.
Well, earlier, Gray says to the president, it didn't work. Get yourself out of there. Get to a safe position. The president's not going to give up. He'd probably, well, he didn't think to do it, so maybe he wouldn't have driven the ship right up into that weapon, which you don't know is going to work, but it does. But I think maybe he would have if he'd thought of doing that.
I agree.
There's a lot of reasons why that makes sense. And one of them is, where do these pilots, the few of them that are left, go if this, and it will, alien ship eradicates them in the Area 51 bunker? The Adam Baldwin character says to Constance, the mountain will provide some kind of shelter. Yeah, but that weapon is going to break through. They're all going to die. So where do these pilots go, including the president, if they don't do absolutely everything they can to stop this thing from killing them all? And they're seconds away from that happening. Randy Quaid gets lucky. And that visual effect, when it explodes, the weapon explodes, is apparently an upside-down version of the Empire State Building going off. And slightly
cool, changed.
And now that I knew that, I read that years ago, I look for it. It isn't obvious, but you can see it if you look for it. That's just the same model, visual effect, probably some CGI, flipped upside down, and of course attached to the model of the spaceship.
It really works. It's a cool effect. Also, I think they stole the design of that mega weapon from the Death Star. I mean, along with a lot of other things this movie borrows from a lot. It gets borrowed from a lot.
Maybe the aliens stole that from the Death Star. They watched Star Wars and said, let's create that.
We know they must have been observing Earth because they knew where all the nice cities are. Of course, they were studying humanity via Randy Quaid. And going to Roswell, I guess, in the 50s as well.
And the nice payoff of him apparently being anally inserted into, although that is a guy who says that, they did things to him sexually and the anal probing. I'm not sure it's Russell saying that happened to him.
No, I don't think he
But you assume that did happen to him. And then how does he destroy them and win the day? He goes up their ass. But that is a theme with the two, well, three heroes. We'll exclude Pullman from this. Steven and David have to go inside the mothership to bring it down, and Russell has to go effectively inside that one ship to bring it down, because they keep on shooting at these things. First of all, they've got a force field, so all their weapons mean nothing. But even when they take down the force field, they don't do very much damage. They run out of missiles awfully fast. The president uses two of them, so he's got four missiles. Two of them are gone that fast. They don't do enough damage. But once you get inside, that's how it works. And that's also the theme of Armageddon a couple of years later. That's not a Roland Emmerich film. That's a Michael Bay film. But as the scientist character in that explains, blow a firecracker in your hand, yeah, it hurts your hand, but close your hand on that. And what's he say? Your wife's going to be opening your ketchup bottles for the rest of your life. Same idea. These guys have to go inside these ships to do any damage. The nuke that David and Steven have on their ship, and then Russell using his missile as well, because it's still on the ship, to go up and destroy that one that's hovering over Area 51. Have you ever heard of or seen the deleted scene in this movie with Russell?
Oh, yeah, I've seen it. It is embarrassing.
And I could see why they changed it, and they really should have, because it doesn't make any sense at all. They must have had to do quite a few reshoots, actually, because there's no reason, realistically, for Russell to be listening to the speech about how you're going to fly this ship. We got to teach you how to fly a plane, a military plane, in a matter of minutes or hours, I guess. Although maybe the logic was, and I forget this, maybe they did all that, but he's still drunk, and they thought, well, we can't use you. Sorry, get out of here. And he slinks off and gets his crop duster, which he did have.
Just to be clear, we haven't explained what happens in this deleted scene, but he gets kicked off the Air Force because he's drunk all the time, and he's so determined that he wants to fight. He gets in his crop duster, somehow gets a nuke on his crop duster. I cannot remember how. And it's him and his crop duster coming in from behind.
Sorry, I'm late, Mr. President.
Yeah, he's like...
Same line.
Right. And he comes in when everybody else has failed, and he flies his crop duster into... It's the same ending, but with a... crop duster.
The alien ships would have killed him so fast and so easily.
It's just embarrassing. In a movie that's full of weird, embarrassing, far-fetched ideas. Well, I guess it's as stupid as escaping a giant city-destroying fireball by hiding in the corner. Just ducking into a little alcove.
Fire does not go around corners.
It doesn't. Yeah, you're fine. It doesn't rob the room of oxygen or heat up the air to the temperature of a active volcano. We just chill, wait for it to pass with your dog.
Boomer!
Gets propelled.
His little tail should have been gone at the very least. It would have been just singed right off.
The dog is just chilling until they call him. The dog sees chaos. He sees his family running away. And he's just sitting there like, I don't know, I'll wait for marching orders.
Point of order. Our dogs might do the same thing.
Oh, our dogs would be at least barking at nothing.
They are dumb.
They wouldn't just sit there.
Right.
They would make a lot of noise and racket, and they would definitely trip several people in their confusion because they're underfoot little jerks.
Yep. Well, that scene actually might be even more absurd, because in the moments of Russell flying into the ship, even with the military plane, doesn't make a ton of sense because so much happens in the dialogue. Like I said, it's probably seconds when you're coming up on this target. Fire one. Doesn't work, tries again. Right there, he's probably gone too far. He might have gone underneath it and past it. But then he has the whole conversation of, tell my children I love them very much, and all right, you alien assholes, and up yours, all that stuff. Takes so much time, it wouldn't really happen. But I actually think that the more absurd thing would be the Vivica A. Fox with her son and the dog getting away from the fireball, because that's an exciting moment and a really great moment visual effects-wise and everything too. But I think you're a little less into that than you are at the very end when we are truly at the precipice. We are truly hanging on the edge. It's like Spielberg having to argue with Peter Benchley at the end of Jaws, where it's this... where the shark is coming at Brody, man-to-man, or sharko-a-mano. Benchley thought it was unbelievable, but Spielberg's point was, if they've gone this far with me, they'll go with me another... And I've watched Jaws, I don't know, 15 times, and I've never really thought about that other than the fact I know that Benchley felt that way. And I thought, you're right, but it doesn't matter. Independence Day with either the deleted scene, that would have been way worse, granted, or the military plane doing what he does, I will basically buy that. But the Vivica A. Fox thing is way more laughable.
Yeah. Randy Quaid's malfunctioning rocket, by the way, it possibly is an homage to Dr. Strangelove. Like I said, the movie has tons of homages to other science fiction films. Although, if it is an homage to Dr. Strangelove, then I think it's safe to say that the point of Dr. Strangelove went so far over Roland Emmerich's head that it is orbiting somewhere Roland. Behind the moon.
Roland.
Wait, that's not what I said.
That's what I heard.
Roland.
We're going to call him Roland. Roland, just Roland, I think.
Is he American?
No.
Where's he from? Maybe it is Roland.
He was born in Stuttgart, Baden-Württemberg, Germany.
Well, until you know how to pronounce Roland with a German accent, I'm going to rest my pronunciation.
Well, we just mentioned Vivica A. Fox, and I've already criticized Mary McDonnell's performance as a dying woman. We loved her in Donnie Darko last week, especially that one great scene with Donnie in the bed when he says, "What's it like to have a crackpot for a son?" It's wonderful.
Oh, my heart.
And in this one, you like her because she seems to have a great rapport with Bill Pullman. The only scenes they have early on are on the phone. And because it's a movie, they probably weren't shooting at the same time at all anyway. She was probably talking to an assistant on the phone, and he was too. But the recurring line of liar, obviously, Thomas Whitmore is not a very good liar, even though he's the president. It's not his natural thing to lie. Of course, he's also a pilot, like he says to General Gray, "I belong in the air." He's not wrong, and they need pilots, so maybe
Come
it's
on.
Dumb, but
they don't need pilots so bad that they could do without a leader.
The country's gone anyway.
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
That's a good what happens next, of course, for this kind of story. So what does happen next? Well, they actually spend a little time mourning the death of billions of people. Just a little bit.
Yeah, it's so frothy. Even before anything terrible has happened, people are making so light of the fact that these giant 15-mile-wide flying saucers are just hovering over all of these cities and nobody knows what they're there for. And people are still just joking around. And then after cities have been destroyed, Will Smith's character, Steven...
Harry Connick Jr. especially.
Harry Connick, they're just joking around. He doesn't know where his girlfriend and his, I'll just say, stepson, he doesn't know where they are.
And
they're
the dog.
Completely and Boomer. They're unaccounted for, and he's still wisecracking away with his buddy.
Well, Connick is more guilty of that than Will Smith is, and he's fun in this small role. Matthew Perry could have had that role, but I'm actually glad it went to Connick, because I think he does bring a lot of life in his brief amount of screen time. I forgot how little he's on screen.
Yeah, me too.
And this isn't his fault, but I wonder about Emmerich and Devlin's tone. They wanted to make a movie that does have a lot of fun stuff, but it is a disaster movie. And disaster movies, by their very nature, can be exciting. They almost always are exciting, at least. And they can be fun. But you really have to get past that whole point of, God, this guy's wisecracking. Of course, that's how people deal with things sometimes. And we hear about that with cops. Homicide cops.
Do you have to get the gallows humor?
Yeah, they've walked into a scene and something might be brutal. Real people, not movies and TV shows, but real people apparently have gallows humor. I've brought it up before. On 9/11, one of my friends, after, I don't know, maybe a few hours had passed by, we were joking that the plane that landed in Pennsylvania was deliberate. Nothing will ever go in that field again. We killed that field! That's a pretty sick joke to make, the day of the tragedy.
You work in the news. You know about gallows humor, mm-hmm. And I don't work in the news, but I have covered terrible news events before, and I've seen it happen myself, and it's incredible how necessary it is. I don't think that's what this movie is going for, though. And I will also add that everybody who's true comic relief in this movie, they die. Harry Connick Jr., that somehow is the motivation for Will Smith to get angry at the aliens, not like his missing girlfriend or the cities that have been...
Jimmy,
No, not my buddy. Oh, we'll never smoke that cigar. Also, Jeff Goldblum's buddy, Harvey Fierstein.
Oh, crap.
I gotta call my lawyer.
Well, screw my honor.
Yeah, that's right.
Because he said the other word that was bleeped out. They wanted the PG rating.
Brent Spiner's another one who is very funny and charming. Actually, like a real breath of fresh air in the middle of the movie, and he comes and then he goes. If you're funny in this movie, you buy it. And the movie's brave in the sense that it does kill a fair number of its characters. When they show a death on screen, it's usually a character that's at least had a line. They aren't these anonymous people. I know that most of the 20,000 characters that are in the film do survive the events. But throughout each major action sequence, we lose some of them that we've been following.
Even Jasmine's stripper friend. We don't know her well, but we talked to her briefly, so she's not a complete nobody.
Yeah, she's like a goofball, an airhead. She's this very light, likable character, and it's presumably sad when she dies. I mean, none of the characters are very deep. They're all incredibly one-dimensional and archetypal. One of the flaws you could say about this script is that it's about as deep as a piece of tissue paper. So you're not necessarily mourning the death of the character, but the fact that they kill off likable characters does lead you to at least believe that there's some peril involved and anybody could die and anything could happen.
Don't forget Russell, comedic character, dies.
Well, okay, but he dies in the climax of the film, and that's his whole arc. He becomes taken seriously. He's like a joke at the beginning of the film, and then he's a hero at the end. That's his arc. So it's not the same as Harvey Firestein, who's goofy and funny, and you like him, and then, oh, I guess he just burned alive.
Mm-hmm. No, he gets crushed by a car.
And doesn't he have, like, a quip? Oh, crap, yeah,
that's
or something.
He says, oh, crap.
Yeah.
That is not, because what else could you dub over? You can see his face. It's not like he's saying, oh, S. He's saying, oh, crap. Interestingly, too, there's a lot of links to movies we've covered recently or movies that these people had done before, because Mary McDonnell and James Duvall, who don't share scenes in either movie, but they're in both Donnie Darko and in this. She's the mother and he's Frank in Donnie Darko. And then Harvey Firestein and Lisa Jacob or Jacob, she is the girl of Russell's family. They're both in Mrs. Doubtfire. Also don't share scenes, but they're related because Harvey Firestein is Robin Williams' brother and Lisa Jacob is Robin Williams' daughter. But they don't share any scenes. So it's interesting you get these movies that these people were in together, but they don't actually share scenes in the different ones. And all in a short period of time, too, a couple years there. A very serious moment when we know for sure the aliens are here to kill and take over is when they blow up the welcome wagon, as they call it. And what I found interesting about that, watching it this time, is that if the aliens hadn't shot down that chopper, the president and his entourage would not have hastily left D.C. They barely make it out of there by seconds, right? So if they had just ignored this, the aliens had just ignored the welcome wagon, or maybe even waited a little bit longer, their countdown is going the whole time, right? That hidden signal in the satellites, tick, 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 wait a little bit longer, the president would not have escaped, and neither would Jeff Goldblum, who's really the reason why the plan works. It's his idea. Well, his father's the genius, apparently. Oh, God. Another comedic character who does actually live, though, Judd Hirsch. Do you think he's Jewish?
Nobody's perfect.
Mel Brooks wrote these scenes, I think. Although, there's, again, some emotion there. Judd Hirsch cares about his son. He wants you to know I'm very proud of you before he goes off on the big mission.
And he's convenient for exposition because he's the guy who doesn't know anything that has to have everything explained to him as well.
He's the one that brings up Area 51. And then the general and the president deny it, but then it's the Secretary of Defense who says, that's not entirely accurate, Mr. President, and that's why they go to Area 51. And now, of course, we know, finally, the government's admitting, yeah, there are some kind of UFOs. They may not be aliens, but there are unidentified flying objects. We're finally admitting that. And they also finally admitted a few years ago that there is an Area 51. They denied it for decades.
Do you think that the UFOs are aliens?
They could be. I agree with that line in Contact, the year after this, the polar opposite of this movie when it comes to alien films. But the line at the end when Jodie Foster says to some kid, that if there's no alien life, that'd be one hell of a big waste of space. The whole universe is just us on Earth.
No, but do you believe that the UFOs are aliens?
That's the flip side, though.
Way different.
Okay,
question.
So there are other beings on all these other worlds. But could they get here? Would they want to get here? And would they come here looking for trouble?
Would they be able to get here? Is it even possible for the technology to be developed to travel those distances?
Well, realistically, we can't even get to Jupiter or Saturn, let alone leave our Milky Way. Do I believe it's possible? Yeah, but realistically, I don't think that it could because of those kinds of mathematical things.
You think there's a different explanation for all of the UFO sightings that have recently come to light?
It's possible. I don't know what the hell that would be, though. Mm-hmm. When you talk about, say, religion, if you believe in God, you can believe that God can do anything. If you want to believe in aliens, you can believe that they have technology way ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
A movie like this points that out all over again. So my brain can't wrap around the idea that these weird-looking, stereotypical as well, Mars Attacks the same year as this, had creatures that are similar, not the same, but similar to this, the squid-looking type thing. Yeah, they've got the biomechanical suit, but otherwise they are...
They're like Roswell aliens. They're alien autopsy aliens. The kind of pop culture idea of what an alien looks like. They don't stray that far. They add a couple tentacles, they make its head a weird shape, but it still has those enormous almond-shaped eyes, slightly smaller than humans and definitely very slender.
And that thing built these ships, let alone the mothership, even the 15-mile ones, doesn't seem logical. But then look
what
we've built.
Oh, look what humans have built, yeah.
Exactly, look what we've built.
It's perfectly logical. Actually, it makes more sense that they would have frail bodies because part of the explanation for humans to have frail bodies is that all of our energies are redirected to things like speech and complex thinking, abstract thought, all that stuff. You require so much energy, there's not that much left over for acute senses of smell or hearing or strength, like a lot of our very close relatives have, like chimps.
Hmm. We just talked about the frail bodies. We find out that the bodies are frail in Area 51, but also when a tough Navy pilot can punch in one in the face and knock it out for hours. But because they have those force fields, they can't actually be attacked. Even the small ships have them. Jimmy finds that out. They got force fields too. So after Jimmy dies, and then Steven takes the one alien on that incredible trip through the canyons and then crashes his plane deliberately, so it'll crash when it's got Steven's parachute in its way, that ship can deflect lasers and missiles and those kinds of things. Yes, it's a mountainside, but it can't just blast through that and be fine?
And they are also the smartest aliens that are also the dumbest aliens. What do you want from planet Earth? Couldn't you just use the plot of Spaceballs and vacuum the air out and suck up the water with a giant straw? Wouldn't that be a lot easier than completely decimating the planet and probably destroying a lot of the things that you want in the process?
But that's one of those metaphors. This movie's not the smartest, as we know from the screenplay, but that's obviously a metaphor of what we do. Because Pullman says in the scene where he communicates with the alien, and that's one of the smart touches in the sequel when he's no longer president, but he's still alive, and that convergence with the alien, where he read its thoughts, messed him up for the decades that passed. But he finds out that they go from planet to planet, taking all the natural resources, and then just leaving, which is what humans do.
I haven't seen the sequel, but as I understand, part of the plot of the sequel is that there's like a federation of other alien races that are trying to work together to eliminate the harvesters altogether. Because, of course, they've hurt so many planets, they've destroyed so many civilizations and cultures and lives. It's not just humanity coming together, it's like the galaxy coming together to fight them.
I saw that movie, and I do not remember that. That's how forgettable that film was.
Well, I didn't see it, I just read about it.
So. Most of the cast members, like I said, are in it. Not Will Smith, and the people that died can't be in it, of course. Pullman's no longer president, but he's in it. Loggia's still General Gray in that. Goldblum comes back. I think Judd Hirsch probably does, I don't remember for sure. And Vivica A. Fox does, because Vivica A. Fox, what a great and appropriate last name. Michael J. Fox, his middle initial is not J. It's A, Andrew or something like that. And he couldn't be Mike Fox. There was somebody named Mike Fox in the union, so he had to be Michael Fox. But he couldn't be that either, so it had to be some kind of initial. But his actual initial would sound like Michael is A. Fox. He thought that's what people say about him.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Vivica A. Fox, appropriate that that's what she went with, because at this point, wow. And she's pretty talented. Is she Angela Bassett? No, but she's got talent. She was in the Kill Bill films, the first one, of course, more so, briefly in the second one. And she is in Independence Day Resurgence. She's worked a ton, especially the last 10 or so years. She's one of those actresses that works so much. But look at her resume and say, I don't know that movie. I've heard of that one. Don't think I've ever heard of that one. Don't know much about that one. I don't really know why. Okay, yeah, woman, black woman. But still, seems absurd that she didn't get more work. Although she's getting a lot of work now, but never really became a star the way she could have.
Well, Hollywood is different now. There's A, more projects around, period, but B, just more projects for black women, and especially older black women, older women, period. The world's really opened up for actors in a way that never was before.
Margaret Colin didn't have all that much of a career after this movie. She only made 30 in total, or has made 30 in total. A lot more TV, so she works, but she never really became any kind of big player. And she's fine as Goldblum's love interest, but she also wasn't in the original cast. I don't know who was, I forget the name now, but that person quit or whatever it was, and they had to recast either during shooting or right before shooting. Now, what about the idea that Goldblum has of giving the ship a cold,
yeah,
the virus, which is a play off the original War of the Worlds, and I guess in a way the remake that Spielberg did about 9 years after this movie. And he would have made that movie sooner, but when he saw this one, he thought, well, Emmerich beat me to the punch. I'm not going to make my movie anymore. And I don't know why he decided to do it after all. War of the Worlds is a pretty entertaining film, also very dark and scary and everything, which I guess is Spielberg's point. But if you thought you were beaten to the punch 9 years before, why did you feel differently later on? Because Independence Day is still the movie that most people would probably watch for this kind of story.
Independence Day is very much a 90s movie. It's almost the blueprint for a 90s fun, dumb action movie, especially a disaster film. Whereas War of the Worlds, the world was really, really different 9 years later. It was a post-9/11 film, and it takes a completely different angle from Independence Day. You focus on one family, and it's not even about them conquering the aliens. The aliens accidentally conquer themselves.
We talked last week about why Donnie Darko didn't succeed more. Marketing was a huge reason why, and maybe they didn't want to market a movie that has a plane in peril and an engine getting ripped off of that plane. But I heard that after 9/11... people were renting Independence Day, and they were renting Armageddon. They were renting all these disaster films, certainly Die Hard as well. That's not a disaster film, but a lot of people die. They weren't watching light comedies. They weren't picking Pixar. They weren't picking the uplifting films. Well, these movies have uplift because in the end, we always win. But they were going after these movies where hundreds of thousands or millions or billions of people died. I don't know why. Maybe because they wanted that point.
Because the heroes saved them.
That's what it is. They're seeing ahead to when we beat the terrorists, which we never really did.
I don't know about you, but I really distinctly remember this feeling very shortly after 9/11. Certainly not once we all had a chance to process it. But when it first happened, I remember thinking, well, where the hell was Arnold Schwarzenegger? Where was John McClane? Why didn't a hero come in and save us at the last minute? We've all been so primed by action films to believe that the worst can't happen because somebody will save us always at the last minute. It sounds like really immature and naive of me to admit this, and of course I knew better, but at the same time there was this rewrite of the narrative in my head of how the world actually works. But in the same way that we had to watch Contagion when the pandemic started, I can see how there was this desire to watch a narrative that just made more sense, because the narrative of 9/11 was really jarring. To go to a safe place where the good guy always wins. I understand that. Now, mind you, when did War of the Worlds came out?
2005.
Oh, so by then, they'd been in Iraq for years. There had been war going on for years. There was this complete mistrust of the government. It was a way darker time. You look at the movies of the 90s. They really gave us a ton of wonderful and terrible action films. We got Independence Day, Twister, Stargate,
The Rock.
Armageddon, The Rock, Con Air. Just unapologetically stupid but delightful pieces of popcorn propaganda. And they veered from that late 80s action film that really did rely on one strong hero and instead gave us these great ensemble casts of heroes working together, fulfilling their role, and of course, the show-stopping special effects. A lot of them were pretty new for the time. And effects like the ones we see in Independence Day, which were practical, but they were still incredible. And they were novel enough to draw a lot of people to the theaters. The 90s were a very peaceful and prosperous time for America, and there was a whole generation that had no significant conflict to worry about, so it really was just good, inconsequential fun to imagine the White House getting blown up, like something that could not be said for much longer. Nobody wants to see the White House getting blown up in 2005, where people were genuinely afraid that terrorists could successfully blow up the White House. Look at superhero films and how dark they got, like Batman in the 90s versus Batman in the 2000s, the Nolan Batman versus the Schumacher Batman.
The Superman movies, too. Even Superman Returns is not as much fun at all as the first two Superman movies that Reeve did in the 70s and into the early 80s. Three and four aren't very good movies, but they still are optimistic. And you just mentioned about where are the superheroes that we see in these movies. Even if they're real people like Bruce Willis, where were you when we actually needed you rather than just in a film? Well, there's other fun moments in this movie. Of course, the fact that Steven, who's on a deadline, marries Jasmine, but she needs the military benefits because our culture is going to be just the way it was before. I guess it's one of those things of let's get married now before you maybe go off and die. The odds are good you will die.
With that ring, that hideous...
Got a thing for dolphins.
Whoo! An engagement ring with dolphins on it, which I read... Dolphins and jewelry had a little renaissance after this movie came out, that it influenced even jewelry production.
If it was small and subtle, I could see that, but those things are impossible to miss. One reason a kid should be smacked or punched or something or elbowed in the face is when the little guy, Ross Bagley, I think is his name, when Vivica A. Fox says to him, "How do I look?" "Nyeh." "Are you kidding, kid?" "A hand-me-down dress that they quickly tailored?" "Wow."
It doesn't matter.
She doesn't need a white wedding dress. Yeah. Wear the dress you have on. You look incredible. We get Whitmore's speech, one of the most famous moments, probably the most famous moment in this whole film. And I love that salute at the end with that one pilot always slays me. But it's definitely an inspirational speech. And I think I read somewhere that the reason why that he does say about it being Independence Day, the last line of that speech, is because they didn't have the rights to that name yet. It was going to be ID4 because there's another movie called, well, I guess long ago, Independence Day. And I guess maybe Fox just ponied up the dough or something like that. And that's the right thing because ID4 is fine. If you type that in on the IMDb, this movie comes up, no different than if you'd actually type in Independence Day. And a lot of people have called it that over the years, too. The marketing called it that a lot of the time. But that isn't the actual title. I assume you think the speech is pretty effective and pretty good?
Yeah, I know people make fun of it, but come on, it's pretty great.
And while that's happening, of course, David and Steve are going up there in the ship that somehow Steven knows how to fly. I've seen their maneuvering capabilities, sir, and I think I can figure this out.
He makes one misstep where he mixes up reverse and forward, and then like a student driver.
He's fine.
Yeah, then he's got it. Although he must go faster.
Yes, yes. Without the oops. that away. I was reading that Goldblum and Smith improvised a lot, as did Goldblum and Hirsch. Ton of improvising. Yeah, I could see that, and that, and that was not written by Emmerich and Devlin, who are pretty good filmmakers. They've made a lot of movies that have succeeded, or movies that are fun. I used to own Stargate, but gave it away at one point, or sold it for a dollar or something like that, but I wouldn't say it wasn't fun. But they wrote and produced and directed that before this one. And then they did Godzilla, which did fail, but that got one hell of a marketing campaign as well. Emmerich directed the sequel. I don't think Devlin was involved. Maybe he was involved. Anyway, they haven't worked together as much in more recent years. And then Emmerich has done a lot of other disaster films, including 2012, which I only saw once in 2012. Is that when it came out? I think it did, didn't it? It must have come out that year.
Yeah, maybe right before 2012. I can't remember. Because there was the whole thing. That
the Mayan calendar.
Yeah, everybody thought the world was going to end.
That one, I believe, is a lot more almost vicious than this one is at times.
Whole swaths of the world getting destroyed. The famous images of the oceans cresting over the Himalayas. You're talking about some next level destruction. He directed Day After Tomorrow as well.
Which, I hated that movie.
Yeah, well, everybody hates that movie, but it was a hit, wasn't it?
It was a hit! It may not have been a big hit, but it was a hit.
He's never caught lightning in a bottle the same way he did with Stargate, a movie that I will also defend. It is as stupid as they come.
That wasn't a blockbuster like this was, though.
Oh, wasn't it?
Not like that. It's not
but
even
that's
close.
Like he got this film made because yes. Stargate was at least very well liked and successful enough. But I don't know if he ever hit the nail on the head again with the same clarity and elegance that he does with Independence Day. And people might fault me for calling this film elegant. The script is stupid, sure, but it sticks to a solid three-act structure. It fulfills each of the main characters' arcs in a really satisfying way. It's dumb in an elegant way, and that's why we've named all of these big 90s disaster films. We haven't named a lot that failed, like Deep Impact or all the volcano movies. There's lots more, and this one absolutely sticks out and is still considered probably a classic now.
Helps you cast a young star who is known only from TV and rapping and get it right with him in the main role, even though I do question the tone. But it's more the conic scenes. But Will Smith's charisma really pulls it off. I guess the whole thing, too, about him punching the alien. I think people, for the most part, might mock it, but love it at the same point. Just like the welcome to Earth and the smoking the cigar. That's an iconic moment. Is it dumb? Yeah. But it's also a matter of machismo in that moment. He won. Then dragging the alien through the desert, and it's a funny scene. Will Smith makes that work, and maybe someone else would have completely failed if they tried to do the same thing.
And the movie's remarkably consistent in its tone. It's always...
I don't think it is. I don't think it is.
You don't.
I said earlier, I think Harry Connick goofing around when they're getting their debriefing from the general or whatever it is that's telling them about how they're going to go about flying against this alien ship, and it's, hold me. He leans on Will Smith. Doesn't really seem like the right thing to do under the circumstances, especially when every little detail this guy tells him is going to be very important. Shut up and listen.
Okay, but I say in the context of the film, there is a lightness throughout, and there's irreverence is the wrong word, but it's frothy, it's silly, and it's fun, even though it's doing the most serious things, so that when Will Smith punches the alien out, you're like, that's exactly what you should do in this world. In this movie, this is exactly what should happen.
And that's the alien that does kill Dr. Oken, because they operate on it. Will Smith, we've covered him once before, Men in Black. The year after this, it was, of course, the July 4th weekend. Will Smith had that cornered for, well, I guess only 2 years, because 1998, I'm not sure if Enemy of the State was, I don't think it was, a July 4th movie. I liked that movie a ton, and it did okay for Tony Scott, but it wasn't a huge hit. And then Wild Wild West, I'm pretty sure, was a July 4th release, and they thought, it's Will Smith, this high concept movie. And that was, of course, a notorious failure. But for 2 years, Will Smith was the man, because Men in Black was monstrous as well. And then Chris and I did him in a completely different role, not that long ago, in The Legend of Bagger Vance. But that's so far all that's been done on this channel or that channel. And now he mostly does prestige blockbusters. And most of them are not movies you really ever care to see more than once, if even once.
When's the last time he even had a hit? He's had a lot of stinkers in the last decade.
I like Will Smith, but I think he might have an ego problem.
Will Smith is great. I don't know if he has the world's greatest taste. I think he's gotten lucky plenty of times, but After Earth or what's that?
Collateral Beauty.
Collateral Beauty. You knew exactly what I was thinking of. Just truly tragic disasters of films.
He doesn't work that much either. He's like Cruise and a lot of other actors who pretty much do one movie a year, but Cruise mostly does things like the Mission Impossible sequels, and they generally tend to succeed. And Smith has done a variety of kinds of films. I don't mind. In fact, I even somewhat like things like 7 Pounds, and Chris and I will probably do Ali before the year's over, where he plays Muhammad Ali very well. But it's too bad somebody this funny and fun and charismatic, for the most part, takes himself so seriously. As you were talking a minute ago, I'm picturing, in some ways, a similar guy as an actor and as a star, The Rock, who, for whatever his faults, does not take himself too seriously. Maybe that's one reason why he's always clicked with people, and Will Smith, people have just gone, no, we've had enough of you, Will.
My take on Will Smith is that he is really like a charisma actor. He is just somebody who's so fun to watch and to look at that he can carry a film with his charm. But he really wants to be a serious actor, and he just keeps trying to put his square peg in these round holes. I think that's why some of these movies fail. He just doesn't belong in them. Whenever I see him in a serious film, I don't think he's very good. But when you see him in something like Independence
Pursuit
Day
of Happiness.
Or Men in Black, of course, is incredible.
Pursuit of Happiness.
Yeah. Where he got nominated for an Oscar. I didn't see it, so I'll take your word for it.
Acting with his kid before the kid became insufferable.
And Ali, he is Muhammad Ali. He does have that over-the-top energy and confidence.
The eyes.
Yeah.
Even the way he sounds. I only saw that movie once, and whenever Chris and I do cover it, maybe I'll be saying different things after seeing it a second time 20 years later. But yeah, I think he grasped all those things pretty well. Like I said already, that Bill Pullman was in Spaceballs on our channel. We did that a couple years ago. In A League of Their Own, we did quite a long time ago. Small role in that. Spaceballs, he's effectively the main character. Pullman and Paxton have been compared so many times. Bill Paxton, I think, is a better actor anyway, and I like him so much. We saw While You Were Sleeping not that long ago. I guess it was around the Christmas time. I don't know if Bill Pullman's a very good actor.
I think he's an okay actor. I don't think he has the charisma that Hollywood seems to think that he has. He seems like a guy that I don't think I would really like that much. And watching While You Were Sleeping, she brings so much charm to that film that she makes up for the fact that he's a bit of a...
drip.
Actually, him and Patrick Wilson, same thing. Although Patrick Wilson is probably a better actor, but as good looking as he is, I never am drawn to
great
look
agent.
At him.
Like I said, a young adult. Great
seriously,
agent.
Seriously.
And good taste. Unlike Will Smith in the last 20 years,
yes.
Patrick Wilson has good taste.
Young adult, he was perfectly cast in that film, but he's been so strangely cast in other films as a hero where he just never pulls it off. And you can tell when they cast this movie that they were like, okay, well, we've blown our budget on the special effects, so we have to save money on actors. So they get Will Smith, who at the time was a TV star. He was a nobody. He had been in a handful of films. He was trying to break into movies, but I'm sure that they got him for scale or slightly more. Bill Pullman was not a movie star at the time, not even close. Jeff Goldblum was never a leading man, exactly. He starred in films. I mean, we covered The Fly, but he was never like an A-list actor. But
he probably had the biggest salary on this film. I didn't read that he did.
Which is funny because he's third billed. But yeah, he probably got paid more than just about anybody else in this film. And nobody else in the movie is somebody who could command a large salary. It's a huge cast. They spent a lot of money on other things. But they weren't going for the Bill Paxton. Twister came out same year, right? Mm-hmm. And that was the Bill Paxton vehicle. And come on, you compare him in that movie to Bill Pullman in this movie. Bill Paxton is so superior.
Because he always was. And they were never that comparable in the first place. People are just lazy in comparing the two.
Alike.
Well, I'm not sure that's even true. Robert Loggia, we covered in Big a long time ago. And Chris and I did Necessary Roughness not that long ago. All right! I always knew that from this movie when they do win at the end. And he does it a few times in Necessary Roughness, so much like Robert Duvall with the exhale, Robert Loggia has the, all right, as a Secretary of Defense, you should have told us. And I mentioned it was a big year for Randy Quaid. Well, it was also a pretty big year for Brent Spiner, who does not act in movies that much. But this same year, he did Star Trek First Contact and Phenomenon. That was a small role, and this is a fairly small role. Obviously, a big role in First Contact. He's got some like 25, 30 movie credits in his entire career, and most of them are in one year, it seems.
I wonder why. Everybody says that he was the funniest person on set at Star Trek, and Data is one of the most beloved characters in all of Star Trek.
And he brings a lot of life to this movie when he comes in, like you said.
Yeah,
he really
yeah.
helps the movie in that midway point. The film is 239-1. We watched it on Disney Plus. They've got so many movies that we're going to do in the future, too. Going through what they've got is one of the reasons why I've picked some of these movies we'll cover in the next few months and have covered in the recent months. Even though we have the DVD of this, we have the DVD of The Fly, but we thought Disney Plus would look better. It probably did.
The addition of, it's called Star or Stars?
Just Star.
Just Star. The addition of that to the Disney Plus catalog, whoo, there's so much there.
And when you watch those films, they aren't cutting anything out. So Disney Plus, you have to, of course, go through the basic motions to make sure that you're not a kid watching this. I'm sure a lot of kids have seen these movies through Disney Plus, but you're not supposed to be able to see them that way. At least they're not editing them. When they get them on the site, it's the movie you know from before. Carl Walter Lindenlaub shot this, along with many other Emmerich films, and one of the Narnia films many years later. The editor, David Brenner, won an Oscar for Born on the 4th of July for Oliver Stone. Did a lot of other Roland Emmerichs, and now he's cutting for the DCEU. That four-hour cut of Justice League, he was at least one of the editors on that. I didn't see if he was the only one.
Which you halfway approved of, didn't you?
I definitely approved of. Yeah. I was going to watch it in stages. I ended up watching the whole thing in one night. I started around 10 o'clock. I thought, I'll watch part of this. I might get tired, or I'll just do something else. But I sat there for four straight hours. And then David Arnold, the music for this movie. You've never been a big fan of music scores in general. But I've always remembered this score. I love the music basically accompanying Randy Quaid's character when you first see him flying the crop duster, that and even at the end with the missile when it misfires, that horrific kind of horror music playing. I think it's a pretty good score.
It does the trick.
You didn't like it then.
It's fine.
He did other Emmerich films and a lot of the recent Bond flicks. So you see Casino Royale, Spectre, those kinds of movies. I believe David Arnold is the composer on those. He's got a pretty diverse career. You didn't love the music then. The cutting isn't bad for a 2.5-hour movie, and I think it looks pretty good. We know the effects are outstanding, both CGI and models.
If you were going to cut it, you would have to cut characters, but maybe you could have cut characters. This movie would have been better if it was under 2 hours.
Apart from having someone to talk to before he gets to the White House, I don't know that Judd Hirsch is all that necessary in this movie.
Oh, I like Judd Hirsch. And like I said before, he serves the purpose of allowing people to explain things to him or for him to explain things to other people.
And David to do it to him. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. He has someone to talk to as he goes to the White House.
But David has Judd Hirsch. Does he need Harvey Fierstein?
Oh, crap. I'm not going to try to do that voice anymore because my throat will be ruined. Although we're done here, so. And we are done, right?
Yeah, my final thoughts are, to be clear, this movie is astronomically stupid and bad in every way. It's also fantastic. You should watch it. Just be clear.
It is still fun. I was a bigger fan of it when it first came out, but this is the granddaddy of modern disaster movies. We can name other ones, but this is one of the most famous and one of the most successful. It may not be my favorite. It isn't my favorite. I would rather watch The Rock, for example, which is not a disaster film. Actually, you know what? The best comparison for me would be Armageddon.
Armageddon.
I've always been a sucker for Armageddon. Maybe we'll cover that in a couple of years.
I'm not a Michael Bay defender by any means. I think most films he makes are just terrible in every way, but Armageddon is, come on, it's a classic. It's so bad. It's so great.
Maybe we'll do it in 2023 when it's, what'll it be, 25 years old. My God. That's it for Sci-Fi Month. Next week, we're going to change gears pretty hard as we go into July and we talk about a much quieter character dramedy, Alexander Payne's The Descendants. The coming attractions opinion question for The Descendants. Which performance in an Alexander Payne movie do you think is the best of them all? So totally an opinion here. Reese Witherspoon in Election, or I guess Matthew Broderick in the same movie. Jack Nicholson in About Schmidt. Paul Giamatti in Sideways. Bruce Dern in Nebraska, or I guess you could say Will Forte in Nebraska. Or George Clooney in The Descendants.
So for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about The Descendants. In the meantime, check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 07 list of the best American films ever made. And there are hundreds more titles on top of that. While you're there, please give us a rating and a review that helps people find us. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
So happy Independence Day to our American fans, and happy Canada Day to our Canadian fans. That, of course, will happen 3 days earlier, only a few days from now.
And a hell of a lot of maple leaves.
Nice. And in honor of Robert Loggia, they won, so all right.
And cut.